And now here is part two of the Tony Benedict interview.
It was too late for me. I'd already, I've learned that we worked alone. We weren't a team. Mm-hmm. Mike worked in his room. I worked in my room. Warren worked in his room. We didn't bounce it off anybody but Joe.
Right.
And it worked that way. Now it's quite different. And
you've got screening committees. You've got focus groups. You've got all kinds of stuff that goes on. Little kids, they show it to little kids. They test it and test it and test it.
Right. Whereas an artist doesn't need to test. Hey, you like this tune? You play it.
Put it out.
Yeah, and they say, wow, yeah. Oh, what kind of marketing research did you do on that?
Paul McCartney. How did the studio change? You were there straight through from 1960 to 1967.
Right.
How did the studio change? Because you told me that in 1967, Joe and Bill sold the place.
Yeah, I believe they sold it first to Taft Broadcasting out of Ohio.
Yeah.
And Bill has said many times to lots of people that they sold out way too soon. And he regretted that. But
it seemed like good money at the time.
Well, I suppose it was, if you could have looked further ahead. But the Disney example should have been pretty obvious to him to keep the standards up and to last much longer. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what slowed things down. It really was the when you go, you have to satisfy the advertisers, then it's not your product anymore. But it still can be incredibly profitable, and so who was to object?
So did you stay beyond 67 when they sold
no.
the place?
Just about the same time. We all knew that it was, coming, but...
The buzz around the studio was going to sell.
Yeah, and that's, changed the whole nature of the place. But I had, about the same time, written a potential television special, a children's television special.
Right.
And I even boarded it all up, and Iwo Takamoto helped me. He designed some characters for me and did some background. It just was a big help on it. And I took it to Joe and pitched it, and he passed on it.
What a crusher.
Yeah, and so I was telling this story to my brother Frank, who was a charter pilot, and I was telling him my story of woe about how my big dream film was turned down, and so Frank, later on, he was flying a client up to Vancouver,
yeah,
and was telling this guy my story,
yeah,
and the guy said, really? He says, yeah, sounds pretty good. And this guy turned out to be a head of a conglomerate up in Vancouver, British.
Columbia.
Marvin Judd was his name. He was the most pleasant man. And so he said, well, can you have him show me what you have? So I flew up to Vancouver, and it was right around Christmas time. And Marvin had his family at his house. We had a nice dinner, and the lights were low, and there was a nice fireplace. And he says, and here's it. He brings out his four children.
Yeah.
He says, tell them the story. And I went through it, and I pitched it like I had seen Joe Barbera pitch stories. Give it some character and make it happen.
This was a seasonal Christmas story.
Yeah, it was a Christmas story. And so it happened to be Christmas, and it was a very Christmassy mood. Anyway, bottom line is they loved it. It was called A Yellowstone Christmas. It wasn't called Santa and the Three Bears. That was a marketing thing that the distributor did. But Marvin bought it right there. He wrote a check to me to get it started right there and then. And he said if he can't get his company to back it, he'll do it himself.
This is the late 60s, right?
This is 68. Now, this is 1968.
And now, you're no longer at Hanna-Barbera at this point?
Right. I left Hanna-Barbera right after I had pitched it. Because, he was going to do it. And so I told Joe, this guy's going to... So he said, "Nah, you'll be back." So, and he's right. I was back later.
This was Uncle Joe telling you okay, you go out and do your thing, but you'll be back.
Yeah, he did, and he was quite right. I was back in the 80s as a story editor on the Jetsons.
Oh, my gosh. And imagine, that went on for quite some time.
It was 20 years later, you're doing a show, and the characters haven't grown any older or anything else, but the way they made them, yeah.
You weren't crazy about the. We'll get into
yeah,
that. But
okay.
Tell me about
but Santa and the Three Bears.
Yellowstone Christmas, or Santa and the Three Bears, as it's known today.
Okay, so I went down and made, I opened up a little studio and hired a few people, and a small crew, maybe there was about 10, and then
You did the whole enchilada. You did the boarding, supervised the animation.
Right, and did the,
yeah,
I did some of the layouts, and then did, just generally went around and got it recorded and so forth. Hal, what was his name? Hal, who was the drunken Andy Griffith art show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Jean Vanderpile was the mother bear.
Yeah.
And
this is an hour special, right?
This was a half hour special.
Oh, it was a half hour?
Yeah. And so anyway, we recorded it, and then I went and made it, and and when it was complete, because I had told Marvin that if we made the film, we can sell it, but.
So you basically made it just with the financing you got.
Made it on spec, yeah, on total spec. And because, I had pitched it everywhere, and nobody wanted it.
You went out and did it yourself.
So I did it, and then, let's see, what is the next sequence? Made the film, everybody's happy, had a nice premiere up in July, up in Vancouver, hot as hell, all these kids here to come see a Christmas movie. Okay, great. Now
now you have to sell it to
now
the distributor.
Okay. So I went the rounds. I went to Warner Brothers. Well, I went to Warner Brothers last. I went to CBS. It was actually I'd gone to Chicago to a advertising agency, Gray Advertising, and they handle Hallmark cards. I was
right.
Trying to pitch it for Hallmark, and they were very enthusiastic about it. And I thought we had a sale, and something intervened. I don't know what. Where all of a sudden they just
couldn't
find a time or some, unconvincing reason. But I went on pitching it everywhere else, and I pitched it to Warner Brothers, and they said, "Hey, okay, we can do that. We'll make it a." Make it a children's matinee thing, but it's only a half hour long. We're going to make a feature out of it. I said, a feature? I mean, well, we'll give you some money, shoot some live action, add a few more songs, and here's the money. So I didn't like the idea, but I had an investor here, so.
She had to make whole, so.
Right, so I took it. Great, now I figure they gave us like, I think, $15,000, which wasn't a lot of money, but for that time it wasn't a little, and to shoot, add some more footage and add songs and so forth, and brought it up to like just barely qualified as feature length.
Probably about 55, 65
yeah,
minutes, right?
Just under 60 minutes. So then Warner Brothers gets purchased by 7 Arts, and they don't want anything to do with this thing.
Yeah, new management.
So I'm back on the road again trying to find a distributor, and I wind up.
But by now you've got it in an hour, right?
Yeah, it's an hour, and I went down to Hollywood, Florida, and there was a distributor down there who distributed children's films and porno films.
There's a nice combination, porn and children's films.
I go into this guy's office, Shelley Shermer. He's got a one sheet of Thumbelina and a one sheet of some porno film. Same actress in both films. And
he's working both sides of the screen.
So he's, we can do that. Well, he was just a typical.
Hard-driving, cigar-smoking huckster.
Yeah, stereotype guy. They were like that. And so, all right, okay, we'll do it. He made a deal, and he gave me money to buy back Warner Brothers, paid them off, and gave me some left over for me, and then he went and printed up 100 prints. And on Thanksgiving in 1970, he let it out there, and it did $500,000 on a weekend with, 50 cents a ticket, 75 cents max. So
he was pleasantly surprised.
Or he wasn't. I often wonder. Because I'm all exhilarated, and I call out my guy and say, hey, it's all happening, and, look at these figures, $500,000 on one weekend. Mm. And, great, well, where's our money? Oh, Shelley, where's our money? Well, we got all these costs here, a lot of money to distribute a film. Mm. So it was impossible to get money out of him. And that dragged on for a couple of years, and finally I had to sell out my shares to the investors, and they eventually recovered all their money, but yeah. I was left to the wolves, and it's still out there now.
Gosh, you're not the first artist that this
I shared the story with a lot of similar stories that
even
people
Walt
have.
Disney went through that.
Yeah, right. That whole distribution thing is a mysterious thing. They have it all worked out.
Yeah, it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to break even.
Which runs up the production cost, because everyone has to make their money in production, because you're not going to ever see it again. Films would cost a lot less if the people that make them could share in some of the revenue.
But they don't do that.
No, that's
they
verboten.
Just don't do that. Okay, so Santa and the Three Bears makes somebody else a lot of money, but not you. And then your career went on for years and years and years. What were you doing after Santa and the Three Bears?
I was very bitter about it. I just got out of the animation business.
You did? You got out of the animation business? How long did that last?
Till about 19... It was late 70s.
Really? What did you do during all that time?
I tried making films on my own, fool's errand. But I actually spent all the money I had left to make a film that was illustrating music. It was the MTV concept, but...
way ahead of its time.
Yeah. And it was in it was widescreen Panavision. It had a four-track quad was the big audio rage at the time, and I had a number of new artists in it. Donovan Leitch, remember Donovan from this?
Yeah,
a number of people that hadn't quite made it all the way.
You were doing concert films before they were in vogue.
And it wasn't a concert. I would take their recorded songs and illustrate them, sometimes with live action, and sometimes with animation.
Yeah.
And so, it had also an element that it was about marijuana was like, because back then it wasn't the hysterical thing now, but people smoking marijuana in it and enjoying it, and that was a part of it, and that really hurt me in getting a distributor. They did not want to get me, and besides, they didn't believe that people would come to watch music. But the music trumped everything, I think, but not the case. So anyway, that busted me. Then I went back to work. I went back to I went to Hanna-Barbera.
You went back to Uncle Joe's place.
Yeah. And they were redoing the Jetsons.
Right. And you came in as story editor.
Right.
So what was the show like because it had only lasted a couple of seasons back in the early 60s. And
I think it only lasted one. But it was like you'd get 26 episodes in one season. So
they had quite a few that they recycled. But when you worked on this, so you were working on the second incarnation of the Jetsons.
Exactly, right. And it was not the same. It was vastly different. And they made a ton of them based on a syndication formula that you needed, like, you know, what, 52 shows to run through a cycle.
Yeah, Disney was doing either 52 or 65.
Right. And so, you know, deadlines were difficult things to achieve if you wanted to really make the show sparkle.
Right.
It was like rushing them out. And so I wrote some of them as well. But then they would get shipped to Taiwan. And, I said, you know, what happened there? Because my boards, I tried to give them the best poses I could and everything else. And I totally ignored them. But, you know, they were being rushed out. So.
Well, you were on that show for the whole run. You did all
right. That was, I think, one year. Yeah. Then I went to work for Frizz over at
Frizz Freeland.
Yeah, I had worked with him when he was still at Warner's on a freelance basis doing some of those superhero things that were. He had a funny superhero group over there. But then when they went out on their own, David and Frizz, and I went to work for them, and I. Was there like a line producer on Daffy Duck special and Bugs and those characters when they would do TV specials.
Yeah.
So I would write and produce those things for them, direct them, and let's see, yeah. And then what happened after that? The business slowed down, and then I moved. I moved up to Seattle, where my family is,
mm-hmm.
and I was didn't have my wife. Both moved up there. Kids all grown up, so and we were living up there. And I went to work for a gaming company who needed animators. I didn't know.
Oh yeah.
Anything about computers, but I knew animation. And so they sent me to computer school, and I learned a lot about that. And then I started animating and
doing the Lost Mind of Mr. Brain.
Yeah, right, yeah. That's one of them. That's the first one I ever worked on. I had a 27-year-old, no, he was younger than that. He was like early 20s, Ward McKilsky, who hired me because of my drawing. And he was a cartoonist, and it was a very skilled artist, and also he could handle computers and understood the whole thing really well, especially this emerging animation kind of computer technology. So Ward helped me, showed me how to do it all, and I would give him, and he liked my drawings and the animation that I would produce, and I'd also help him write the plots for some of these games that actually needed plots. And so that gave me a great training experience. And
so how many video games did you do all together? And you were doing these up in Seattle, right?
Right, yeah. I only worked on a few of them. Some of them I don't even remember. There was a lot of them, but I can't.
That was all through the middle 90s.
Yeah, right. And so from there, Ward got hired by Disney and their Disney Interactive. So he went down there and then he hired me. And I came back to Disney's for the third time. The second time, I think I missed.
Second time you came back to work on 101 Dalmatians.
No, second time I came was on television for some stupid Saturday morning show called...
you worked for Disney Television Animation.
Yeah, right. That may not be in there. Mike Webster.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, I was
early
a story
days of Disney television
right,
animation.
Right. And from there, I think I went to
Frizz Freeland.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm up in Seattle, and I'm back at Disney. And
so you moved back down here.
Yeah, I'm and working at Disney Interactive, so doing games again. Great, that was standing along nicely, and then all of a sudden, everybody's called together, and there's a mass layoff.
And you're right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I'm gone again. I don't know.
That's kind of a theme with animation people. Just as you think things are going well,
that's the time to watch out.
That's when the suits come down and say, don't worry, everybody's fine, and a week later you're laid off.
Yeah, it's those reassurances that, you know, it's
well,
over.
And that's just, you know, the funny thing that you say that, that's the one theme that I've told people over and over, where you have to start worrying is if the suits come down and say, don't worry, everything's fine. If they don't show up, you're okay. But if they come down and say, don't worry, everything's fine, start calling around for your next job because you're not going to be there much longer. Do you find that to be your experience?
Yeah, that was, yeah, that is indeed. So anyway, I think that was after that. I think I retired. Yeah, I didn't go. No, wait, no, I didn't. It was another, I went to work for a film company, Energy Productions by the name. They shot time lapse.
Yeah.
And would build up a stock footage to sell to clients. I worked for them for a while, and they were purchased by Getty Images.
Oh, yeah.
And so then I went to work for Getty Images as an art director and spent, you know, several years with them. And then I retired.
And then you retired.
Yeah.
What year was that? That was not that long.
That's at
ago.
Least 10 years ago.
So about 2001?
Yeah, it feels more like that, yeah.
Now I have one last question to ask you that I ask everybody. And this covers your inspiration in animation. What I want to know is, of the films that you saw as a kid or as a young man in animation, not live action stuff, although you could hit that, what are the five animated features or shorts or television half hours that really got your juices flowing and inspired you? Do you have five? That, mm-hmm. You know, most people say, well, when I was seven, I saw Pinocchio. Or, you know, when I was this age, I saw that. What would you say are the five pieces of animation that really inspired you to drive onward and upward in the animation business, or even brought you into it? Because you came out, how long were you in the Marines? You were in the Marines.
3 years.
Well, 3 years. So had you artistic aspirations prior to the Marine Corps?
Oh yeah, yeah. I learned at a very early age how to get a laugh out of people with a joke. I used to like read Collier's and Saturday Evening Post. They had those one-panel gags in there, and I loved that. I loved the short, quick humor. And I was raised mainly in like boarding schools for impoverished. Or they would call them homeless children now, and it was. The hierarchy, social hierarchy, was, you know, strict. But I was always up there with these, drawing these gags, you know, and people would laugh. They were like, I imagine, pretty crude drawings, but, you know, I was 8, 9 years old, I can remember, when I first started doing that. Then I got better at it. And I, all the time, I just loved to get laughs out of people.
But you did it with drawings rather than being the clown, the class clown.
Yeah, no, I'm not a very... you know, socially, I guess, you know.
You're shy.
Yeah, I guess you call that, but call it that. But anyway, I like getting those laughs, and I think most comedians are like just getting a laugh. You do anything for a laugh because it makes you laugh.
Right.
It really
is what you live for.
So anyway, that's how it just, and I was always doing gags, and even in the, when I was in the Marine Corps, I had, they sent me to, you know, you go to boot camp and then they evaluate, you say, you know, what you're good for. Most of them were shipped off to an infantry as cannon fodder, but me and a few others were sent to school. And I was sent to the U.S. Naval School of Photography and Motion Pictures in Pensacola,
Florida.
Well,
no wonder that you got into the motion pictures in a big way.
Yeah, I learned all about, you know, the old way, how to expose film, and, you know, but there was nothing aesthetic about it. You just record sound, expose film. They think in documentary terms, and that was about it. And photography, we learned that, you know, film and so forth. So that was, you know, great training. so that when I, and also then when I got out of that school, I was sent up to Cherry Point, North Carolina, and they was assigned as an artist on the base paper. That was my job. But my other job was I was a boxer. I was on the athletic team. The Marine Corps had a great athletic program. Every sport there is, and big crowds that come out. But I was a boxer, and we would travel around various Marine bases and fight each other.
An exhibition.
No, we'd fight it out. It were actual fights.
Boxing
and they were,
matches.
And I wound up going to, right here in Santa Ana, the Marine Corps championships.
Oh, yeah.
Boxing championship from the whole...
Santa Ana Lighter Than Air Base.
Yeah.
It was up there. Yeah, I know. Well, that's where I did my Navy Reserve duty.
Ah, right. Well, same outfit. Same. The Marines are just part of the Navy.
Yep.
Yeah. I went to aviation school, though, too, before I wound up in photography school.
Yeah.
Where we'd get in these big old planes, and they actually got the crank one up, and they shudder and shake. Oh, World War II planes. They were all tied down, but they wanted to give us a feel of what it was like. And so I learned a lot about aviation, and I grew very fond of that. And later on, I bought myself an airplane. I used to I used to pick up assignments. I'd be in Seattle and fly down here and get an assignment even on
the flights. So on top of your many other talents, you're a pilot.
Yeah, yeah, I used to love to fly. It was just, now it's really tough because even then it was kind of, instrument flying, you had to pay attention, and but the skies weren't as crowded as they are now.
Oh, yeah.
And so.
Oh, yeah.
But I used to fly over to Catalina. They got a little short runway at the top of the hill up there.
I worked for a guy, Willie Radiman, that was a pilot. He
I know Willie was a, I used to...
A World War II pilot.
No kidding. See, I never knew any of that stuff. I'd be at the bar with him and Volus Jones at the Alphonse's, and I'm asking all about stuff. How do you know?
Do you know that Willie Radiman was the vice commander of the Burmese Airlift?
No.
He was the second in command.
Really?
And then he was an airline pilot when he got out of the service. And then he came back to Disney and became an animator again. He'd been an animator before the war.
Wow. Isn't that incredible how people sacrifice? Like Ted Williams, too, gave up career to fight a war.
I love Willie. I worked for him for several years.
But, yeah.
Anyway, so your five pieces of animation. Do you have...
I never thought in those terms. I guess I just like the total thing just sucked me in. Yeah, I pick one out. It's like choosing among your children. That's, the usual suspects, come to mind. Pinocchio. I thought Pinocchio was, really great, even when I watched it again when I was 50 years old.
But look at the Flintstones. You walked in on that from UPA. That must have been some sort of inspiration working with Mike Maltese
all those guys were just great. Well, I got a lot of I don't know what there's inspiration, but maybe more thievery from shows like Belko and those.
Oh yeah, okay.
Car 54, Where Are You? I love that basic. It wasn't sophisticated humor. It was cartoon humor.
Yeah, yeah.
And I even submitted scripts to him once. Didn't get any reply, but people I submitted to wound up working.
Really? So you probably were supervising them.
No, I wasn't never supervising. I was never a supervisor. But I was a story editor, but I don't. That's not the same thing, is it? Yeah. I never quite understood what a story editor was supposed to do.
Supposed to make sure the scripts are all on mark.
Yeah, and that was often in dispute. What was on my, and that's where Bibles came around, and like just
all that stuff. Actually, so the Flintstones didn't have a Bible per se.
I never saw a Bible in my 6 years there on any show.
So it was just you went in and pitched to Joe and started doing it.
Yeah,
that was the way it worked.
Right, and it would grow from there. Yeah, that's how they all began.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody there was familiar with these kind of stories, when Mike goes in and pitches a short to Joe that they had made three or four versions of the same thing at MGM and Warner's, So, you know, they knew what
they were
dealing
with.
Yeah, just a different character doing the same thing. Yeah. Nothing's new except what's been forgotten.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's a good place to end. Nothing's new except what's been forgotten. Thank you, sir.